40 years ago, Robert Reich noticed most American incomes were flattening out even while the economy continued to grow. Since then, he writes, the lion's share of economic gains have gone to the top. In his time, Robert Reich has been a writer, teacher, advisor to Clinton, Ford, Carter, and Obama. In his 18th book, Coming Up Short, A Memoir of My America, he set himself the task of explaining urgently why it's so important to reverse the staggering inequalities and legalized bribery that characterize today's America. Coming Up Short was immediately number one on the New York Times bestseller list the week it was published. And Robert Reich joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Well, David, thank you so much for having me.
Look, bullying. Bullying is a theme throughout this book, and it's really how you start. You dive in with the notion that societies that allow bullies are not civilized.
Well, that's exactly what I believe. And I think that belief comes out of my own personal experience when I was a very, very young boy, 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old. I was always extremely short, which is part of the title, a little bit of a double entendre coming
indeed,
up short.
Indeed.
But I believe that a civilized society constrains bullies. A civilized society is not one in which you have a kind of Darwinist or social Darwinist survival of the fittest. It is, to the contrary, one in which people can be relatively secure in their lives, even if they are relatively powerless, relatively weak, relatively poor. That human life, human beings, have a certain intrinsic worth, and a society does whatever it can to protect that worth. Now, that's my faith, that's my belief. Others may have very different views. They do, obviously, have very different views. We have a president now in the United States who has a very different view.
A markedly different view. But Robert, I'm wondering why that principle seems to be better understood in Europe than it is, and in Australia, than it is in the United States.
I think, David, it has to do with a very, very sad, unfortunate history in the United States, both of slavery and also of the near extermination of Native Americans. And when you have a society built on those two kinds of fundamental injustices, beyond injustices, I mean, they were slavery is kind of the final degree of the powerful subjugating, oppressing the less powerful. And the near eradication of Native Americans is another example. When you have a society built on those two historical foundation stones, I think it's just very, very difficult to create a society or to develop a society that has social justice and human rights at its center.
I wonder if the American dream comes into the argument here, that instead of a safety net, instead of the care of government, people in the United States are offered this dream that they can succeed, that all will be well, that this is what the United States offers. And so things like care and equality don't matter so much because there is this dream.
Well, the American dream is obviously a fiction, and there are periods of time, and I think the last 20 years is such a period, in which many people understand that it's a fiction. I mean, the reason in 2016 that both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump were selected by the American public in various ways, various forums, various manners, to be their next political leader, one of them, I think speaks to some very different idea A lot of people felt in 2016, and I know this because I was preparing a book at the time, and I was wandering around the United States, taking notes, undertaking what might be kind of a free-floating focus group with various people who I met. And I'd ask them, who are you for in the coming election? Well, they would say Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. And I'd say to them, why? And they'd say to me back something that was very, very important. And that is that the system is rigged against the average working person. People at the top have rigged the system against us. So you see, David, the American dream was extinguished. I think most people by 2016 understood that it was gone.
Right. And that impulse was true, wasn't it? That the notion of the rigged system was true.
It had become true, exactly. Mainly because the wealthy, beginning in the 1970s, I mean, I was there, I saw it, I had a front row seat. The wealthy began using some of their wealth in American politics to get candidates they wanted who would reduce their taxes, who would reduce any kind of constraints on them gaining as much wealth as possible, including getting rid of environmental regulations and worker safety regulations on their businesses, and they poured money into politics. And that money in American politics from the wealthy made the Americans who were at the top, the wealthiest Americans, even wealthier. So you see the ratchet effect. It's kind of a doom kind of machine that kept working its way for the next 30, 40, 50 years as the wealthy got wealthier, put more and more of their money into politics, tipped the scales in their favor, rigged the system against the working class and against average working people, shrank the middle class of America, and ultimately caused part of that working class, middle class, to elect a demagogue named Donald Trump.
Let's roll back decades before the demagogue and go to a point that you make very powerfully in the book, which is that there came a time when the Democrats needed the money of the rich too. Is that the tipping point in this saga?
Well, it's one of the tipping points. The saga is really about how step by step, both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party succumbed to big money. And the Democratic Party, I saw that too. It was in the 1980s. The Democrats in the House of Representatives thought that they would be there and be in control forever. They had been in control since the 1930s, most of the time. And they said to themselves, well, why should we allow the Republicans to collect all this money from big corporations and the wealthy when we are the ones who are going to have the power? So why don't we do it? They entered into a Faustian bargain. Because, of course, once they were dependent on that big money from the wealthy and from big corporations, the Democrats could not easily separate themselves from it. Now, I don't want to create a false equivalence here, because I want to make sure your listeners know that, at least I believe, that the Democratic Party has been much, much more responsible in terms of the welfare of average working people, than the Republican Party, really starting with Ronald Reagan. But both parties are tainted, and there needs to be an explanation, and I tried to provide it in the book, for why the Democratic Party failed to be as strong an opposition to this poison of big money that was tipping the playing field, that was rigging the entire economy for the benefit of those at the top.
There was a time when big money was walled out of the American political process, at least to some extent. But these days, is there any break at all on big money in the politics of America? Any break at all?
Well, by break, if you are asking, is there any sign that big money is not playing the dominant role that it has played increasingly over the last 30, 40 years? No. In fact, it's getting bigger, and the people at the top are getting richer. And we're talking about not just the top 1%. We're talking about the top 1/10 of 1%. I mean, this administration in Washington, the administration that is Donald Trump's administration, is an administration that is essentially by and of and for billionaires in America.
Is he looting the joint?
Sorry?
Is he looting the joint? That's been suggested to me that the empire is over, and what you do at the end of empires, Rome is one example, Spain another, is you loot the joint.
Well, they're looting the joint. They are. Trump is, by most estimates, billions of dollars richer than he was when he came into office for his second term. Billions. And the insider trading that's going on by politicians and cronies of Trump, who are obviously getting tipped off before he makes announcements that move the stock market and the bond market. Trump himself is getting paid off by the nations of the Middle East. Look at Qatar, look at the Saudis investing in his family's businesses. Look at what's happening with crypto, the crypto industry, making payments to essentially members of Congress who are friendly to crypto, not just payments in terms of their campaigns, but also, we have the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, of all people, who was one of the kingpins of the crypto industry, and who told members of Congress at his confirmation hearing that he would get rid of his, or put it into a blind trust, his crypto investments, but he hasn't. There's no sign that he has. And David, I could go on and on and on. So there is looting. Yes, it's looting in a very cynical way.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Robert Reich, the former Labor Secretary to Bill Clinton, which is what I want to ask him about now. You knew Bill Clinton. He was a friend of yours. He appointed you Labor Secretary. You must have thought that you could now make profound change in the United States. What did you find?
It was pure grandiosity on my part, David.
It's ambition, Robert. It's not grandiosity.
Oh, it was grandiosity. I mean, yes, it was ambition, but I assumed that I would have more ability to shift Clinton's mind and the mind of all of the political actors who were very significant and powerful. I obviously didn't. I mean, there were, I won't say that we didn't do anything that was important for working people. We did. Raising the minimum wage and ending a lot of sweatshop labor and helping people with their pensions and getting better jobs. But ultimately, the structure of the economy, of the U.S. economy, was not changed. And the structure of the underlying rot, the bribery, the legalized bribery at the heart of that economy was not fundamentally changed. And so I don't want you to believe, or anyone listening to this, to think that I was completely disenchanted and I gave up angry. No, I stayed there for almost 5 years, worked as hard as I've ever worked, and tried to do what I could. But when I say grandiosity, I mean I was naive. I thought it was possible to in a very kind of quixotic way, tilt at the windmill of America and change the political culture. Well, I couldn't possibly do that.
You make the point in the book that when Clinton came to office, he had to deal with the deficit that had been created for him, and that was a break on ambition for him and for you, and the deficits since have only got more enormous. Is the deficit the continuing limiting factor for social reform in the United States?
Well, it is, but it should not be. Because what Republican presidents have done since Ronald Reagan is they've run huge deficits. I mean, really, really gigantic deficits. In fact, if you didn't have the Reagan and the Bush, George W. Bush, and the Trump deficits, you actually would have an economy in the United States that was very financially stable and very good. But those Republicans, those Republican presidents, intended to starve the beast, in the words of David Stockman, who is Ronald Reagan's budget director, starve the beast in the sense that making it almost impossible for any subsequent Democratic president to do much, because you see there was the deficits were so large. Also, every major economic crisis the United States has had over the last 100 years has been under Republican presidents. Look at Herbert Hoover and the great crash of 1929. Look at George W. Bush and the extraordinary recession that he left his counterpart with after the end of his tenure. And then also look at the Trump recession, which was partly due, granted, to the pandemic. But Donald Trump did very, very little to stop the pandemic. In fact, there were times, I remember, during the pandemic when I thought he was encouraging it. So these are not economic stewards. These are people who really have lowered tax rates dramatically on the most privileged members of society, the rich, the wealthiest members of society, and then left Democratic presidents to clean up the messes, as if they had a giant pooper scooper.
But to go to another of the big issues here, which is not so much discussed, but is discussed very thoroughly in your book, and that is the destruction of the union movement. That there is now no longer, and has not been for some time, a countervailing power to wealth. How did the United States allow its union movement to be broken?
Well, it starts again with Ronald Reagan, who fired the United States air traffic controllers for going on strike. Now, it is true they didn't have a right to strike. They were public employees. But by firing them all and crowing about it, Ronald Reagan legitimized CEOs of very big companies busting their own unions, doing whatever they could to minimize union membership. Despite the National Labor Relations Act in the United States, which had been passed years before in 1935, which made it an offense, illegal to try to bust unions. The penalty for making it hard to form a union, or to even firing somebody who tries to create a union, the penalty is just a slap on the wrist for a company. I mean, at worst, they have to reinstate that particular employee and give that employee back pay. Well, that's nothing. I remember when I was a labor secretary, companies used to flagrantly disregard labor laws in the United States. And I would talk with CEOs, and I would try to reason with them. I would try to encourage labor leaders in the United States not to be too discouraged, telling them that it was possible to revive the labor union movement. But To give you just an example, just an illustration of what's happened, the dramatic difference. In the 1950s, in the mid-1950s, over a third of all private sector workers in America were unionized. Today, it's only 6%. David, we've gone from a third to 6%. There's no power any longer to speak of in the union movement.
You talk about the way in which the Democrats have turned their backs in so many ways on the workers. But what did Democratic presidents, what did Clinton, Obama, Biden do to strengthen the union movement? Anything?
Not very much, although to give credit where credit is due, Joe Biden did more than either Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. Joe Biden actually walked a picket line in a strike. Joe Biden appointed very tough, diligent, responsible people to the National Labor Relations Board and to other positions where they would have some influence. He made sure that unionized workers had all their rights and that companies that violated the old National Labor Relations Act really did pay a stiff price, as stiff a price as was possible. Joe Biden really was, when he was president, a very, very pro-union president. I cannot say the same for Bill Clinton or for Barack Obama. I think both of them were very good presidents in different ways, but they were not pro-union presidents in a strong or significant way.
I wonder if the issue here is wider than the political parties, because it seems in so many ways that the union movement lost the regard of the public. You write, America had a civil rights movement, a women's rights movement, a gay rights movement, a consumer movement, an environmental movement, a poor people's campaign, and an anti-Vietnam War movement, but no movement to lift the living standards of the working class.
Well, that's, I think, a tragedy. I think it's partly the fault of the Democratic Party. I think it's partly because certainly by the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the middle class in the United States was very large. It was the largest middle class the world had ever seen. And I think in post-World War II America, the assumption was you no longer needed to worry about countervailing power. The economy was working on all cylinders for all people. And then it began to fall apart. That's when you have, starting in the late 1970s, and certainly under Ronald Reagan, the beginning of this dooms machine, this kind of ratcheting effect that I mentioned before, where the people at the top start getting richer and richer and begin paying off politicians and buying their way to a different kind of economy, different rules, different laws that advantage them and disadvantage everybody else.
Is it reversible? I'm wondering whether the United States could ever imagine another Woodrow Wilson coming along and campaigning against the powers that have governed us, development, and that have determined our lives, to actually confront this power.
Well, you know, interestingly, Donald Trump in 2016 did campaign as that kind of a presidential candidate. People forget it now. But he told America he was going to be on the side of the working people. He was going to create manufacturing jobs again. He was going to strengthen the power of American workers. He was going to change the economy. And, you know, he obviously hasn't. I mean, his only major economic policy in his first term was to lower taxes on the wealthy. And in his second term, that's also what he's done. And he's also raised tariffs and conducted this war. neither of which helps the working people in the United States. I mean, in fact, prices are just soaring in America.
But Robert, what is it about his followers that, having been told he is their champion, they see that the only kind of tangible thing that he's put in place is massively more privileging the rich? What is it about his followers that they don't just turn their backs on him at that point and say, you're a fraud, mate?
Well, they may still. I mean, they don't like foreign wars. One of his promises, in addition to getting prices down, was to avoid foreign entanglements. No more wars in the Middle East. Well, let's put it this way. If they don't see that he has directly, unconscionably violated the two tenets of his re-election campaign, then I think one must conclude that it is purely a kind of religious cult,
yes,
following that he has. That it's not really based on rationality at all. It's based on just a feeling. A lot of people I talk with who do consider themselves followers of Donald Trump tell me that he's very authentic. He's very sincere. They just like him personally. Now, when they tell me he's authentic and sincere, I think I understand what they're saying. He speaks his mind. He avoids what's called political correctness. He says outlandish things. You know, somebody he dislikes dies, and he says, good, I'm glad they're dead. Well, you can kind of see how that's taken and confused for sincerity and authenticity, and that in turn is confused for somebody being on their side. But that's why a Democrat has got to come along. And let's hope, I'm hoping, that we have in the next few years the emergence of a charismatic Democratic leader, capital D, who tells the working class what's really going on, who speaks truth to power, but has enough personal power in terms of the confidence and backbone that they project, that they're able to genuinely convince people that they're just not another part of the elite. What I want to emphasize with you and your listeners is that the strongest feeling, the strongest attitude in American politics today is anti-establishment, anti-elitism. And any politician that can really be the champion of that kind of anti-elitism, I think, has a very good chance. We see it in the special elections that have been happening over the last year and 3 months. You've got a lot of Democrats being elected, even in places where Donald Trump did extremely well in the 2024 election. Why are they elected? Because they have been focusing directly, like a laser, on issues of affordability, on questions of, you know, how we get prices down. Some of them are doing what they should be doing. They're talking about monopolies. They're talking about the fact that so much of the American economy is now really under the hands of a very few CEOs and investors, and the entire economy is concentrating. Well, you obviously you're going to have prices increase when you have so much monopoly power. And Democrats need to be, you mentioned Woodrow Wilson, well, they need to be the party of Teddy Roosevelt, who was a Republican, Woodrow Wilson, and others at the turn of the last century, the last time there was a what might be called a gilded age, the first gilded age in America. We're now in the second. The last time there was a gilded age in America, you had trustbusters, anti-monopolists, who came to the fore and said to the people, this must end.
You're an optimist, aren't you? But.
Yes, I am. Yes. I have to be.
An unbeatable optimist, yes.
Well, I mean, you have to be, because how can you be an advocate and an activist if you aren't optimistic? If you give it up, if you turn cynical, then the game is over.
That war. What does it say about the influence of Israel in America?
Well, Israel has a very big influence, obviously, in the United States. And AIPAC, the American Israeli Political Action Committee, is extraordinarily powerful. One of the problems I think many Americans have is distinguishing, and this is a very important distinction, between, on the one hand, Israel, the Israel we see today, Netanyahu's Israel, on the one hand, and on the other, anti-Semitism. I think it's possible to be very anti-Netanyahu Israel and not be an anti-Semite. I mean, I'm Jewish. I'm very proud of being Jewish. But I am appalled by Netanyahu's Israel.
Robert, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.
I have been speaking to Robert Reich, former professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, author of a memoir that he has called, with brutal self-criticism, Coming Up Short. It's published in Australia by Penguin. Robert also writes columns for The Guardian, which is where I read him all the time. He writes a daily newsletter as well on Substack. I don't know how he does it. The words and thoughts pour out of the man.